Morning.
Morning.
Nice to be here. Thanks very much to Jacob Pomerenke and all the people at Sabre for choosing me to do this talk. This is my first talk at a national, so please be gentle with me. Secondly, I'd like to apologize to all of the Pittsburgh Penguin fans. If you're wondering where your cup is, we have it in D.C. Fine. I love it, the boos and the claps. Thank you very, very much. I appreciate that. I'd like for you to take all of that fandom that you have and come back with me and to 1957 and look at a fat, pudgy, skinheaded, uncoordinated little league catcher trying desperately to be a baseball player and looking up to a hero. And only one person in Washington, D.C. was able to bring one thing to that town, hope, and that was Roy Sievers. And I chose to do Roy after I retired from my teaching gig at the Landon School in Bethesda, Maryland, because he was my hero. It's just that simple. And I said to myself, I'm going to do this guy's biography. He was my hero. And a baseball hero is something different, as Tom Boswell says. Let's be real. We are all of us in this room of a certain age, and we're all nostalgics. And this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to capture the essence of a man who meant something to me as a young boy. Your first baseball hero is the first time that you actually incorporate your feelings into someone else other than your parents. It's the first time that you are emotionally invested in anyone. And I was so emotionally invested in Roy Sievers at that time because, let's face it, there was nothing in D.C. Not since 1933, which was the last time they went to a World Series and lost in seven games to the Giants. For 20 years, there was nothing in Washington. Oh, we had Mickey Vernon, who was a great hitter, two-time batting champion and stuff like that, but that doesn't put butts in the seats. Roy Sievers came to the team in 1954 and with one arm was hitting home runs over a 407-foot fence. We'll get into that in just a little bit. But I want to talk to you today about Roy Sievers, you know, my hero. Born in the shadows of the old white water tower at 20th and Angelica Street in St. Louis, Missouri. Of Walter and Anna Sievers, there were four boys. I was very fortunate to be able to interview his brother Bill, who is still with us. He's 95 years old, God bless him. And he was just so effusive with his phrase of Roy. Roy was born into a baseball family. His dad, Walter, got a tryout and actually a contract with the 1916 Detroit Tigers. But as it was in immigrant days back then, when daddy says, no, you're not going to play baseball, you don't play baseball, because they looked upon it as a little boy's game, and they didn't realize that you could make money at it. I mean, we've all probably read Lou Gehrig's biography, and his mother was so definitely against him playing this game that, you know, he had to convince her. Same thing with DiMaggio's parents. His father said, what are you going to play ball? In his broken English, you know, you're not going to play baseball, and wound up to be one of the greatest players of all time. But the old folks, you know, you were a bricklayer, you were a carpet layer, you did that, and you brought the money home for the family, and that's what you did. So even $50 a month, which was an astronomical sum at that time, was not enough to make Grandpa Sievers say yes. So Roy grew up, oh, there he is, the Clark Gable of Beaumont High School. He was a very, very handsome guy up in the high school. And after I talked to his brother Bill, nobody had to teach Roy anything. He just came to it absolutely naturally. And this is one thing that I say in my book, which is, I think you guys have seen this before. All you got to see is home movies of Michael Jackson dancing in his living room when he's 5 years old in Gary, Indiana, and you look at this kid and you go, wow, this kid has got it. He's got it. Whatever it is. I call it transcendence, but it is that special it, that thing, that blessing that God goes, boom, you can hit the ball. And that's what Roy could do. His brothers always said no one had to teach him anything. He did very little on his swing until he got into the major leagues, and then he sort of copied Ducky Medwick and Ted Williams a little bit. But he got it all on his own. He was a natural, not to pun the movie. So Roy Sievers at Beaumont High School, as you read, was just a hotbed of talent during that time period. Dick Williams and Earl Weaver, Chick Deering, Jim Goodwin, all these people went to Beaumont High School, and it was the place to be for sports. Roy was a three-sports standout player in baseball, who took the team to three championships, basketball player, where he got his squirrel nickname, and his football team, and he told me unequivocally, and he said this before, he had to convince his team. The whole team came to his house when he was like a senior and begged him to sign to play football. And his dad said, "No, I want you to play ball. I want you to play baseball." And so he was really torn. He could have played baseball. He could have played basketball. He was scouted by the University of Illinois. Could have gotten a scholarship. Decided to play baseball right out of school. So Roy is signed in his senior year, does 2 years in the Army, and then is brought up to the parent clubs after just 2 years in the minors. He really did a good job. He did a good job his first year in 1947. 1948, he went to double-A ball, and they figured him out real fast. And they sent him down to the Triple I League in Illinois. And there he tore it up, and there he tied for the home run and RBI crown in 1948. In 1949, he said, "I am not going to go back to the minors again," and he put on a real show for his manager in spring training, and they decided to keep him and not send him down, not send him to the Toledo Mudhens, where he would have played the outfield with Mac Klinger. thank you for getting the joke. In 49, as you can see, what his career numbers were, 306, 16 home runs, and 91 runs batted in, which led all rookies in that year, and he gets the first American League Rookie of the Year that year. He loved Bill Veeck, and this was really important to him because I'll take that back there. 1949, he has a fantastic year. 1950, he slumps really bad. They figure him out, and he just can't hit a breaking ball, and his shoulder's flying over. In 1952, he starts off bad again, playing third base of all stupid positions to have him play. And so they said, "No, you can't do this." They sent him down to Beaumont in 1951. He goes down to Beaumont in 1951 and goes to lay out for a fly ball in the outfield and completely separates his shoulder, completely chronically dislocates his shoulder right out of the ball, out of the socket, completely just hanging limp, and the whole thing. They put it back together, and he was out for the rest of the season. 1952, he comes back to try and do spring training, and they put him at third base. He's hitting the ball okay, but he throws his arm out again in 1952. Totally tears it right out of the socket again. So Bill Veeck pays to have an experimental operation at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore to put his arm back together. This is I saw his scar when I interviewed him before he showed it to me. I mean, they completely cut him all the way open and exposed the whole thing in the bone. It was a very, very severe operation. And if it went, when you read the book, and I'll be signing at the McFarland table when I'm done, it tells all about the operation. It was really pretty grisly back in 1951. So he's out for the rest of 51 and 52. In 53, he comes back, and he's respectable. He has a decent year, but he's not hitting with anywhere near the potential that he should be. This is about the Eddie Guidel incident, and I'm sure you've known all about that. But he was very evocative about that. He told me a great story, and it's all in the book. And I want to focus on Roy and stay with Roy. In 53, he gets into 92 games, and he hits a respectable 270, 8 home runs, and 35 RBI, which is nothing anywhere near his output, which would be later in life. So in 1953, I'm sure you all know the story that, you know, Bill Veeck is pretty much run out of St. Louis because of the Eddie Guidel incident and all of the other foolishness things that he did in St. Louis at that time. The owners wouldn't approve his sale to Baltimore, so he finally just had to sell the team outright, and then they said, okay, you can move the team, since they had, you know, another team. He couldn't afford to keep the team in St. Louis. So Roy is gone with the team. He's supposed to become a Baltimore Oriole, but Jimmy Dykes finds the letter that was written by Dr. George Bennett saying that Roy basically couldn't throw normally. Remember, here's the word, he couldn't throw normally anymore, which is, you know, overhand like that. It just wouldn't work. His arm would fall out again. So Roy developed sort of a three-quarter sidearm kind of sling in order to get the ball in there. Jimmy Dykes thought he was damaged goods, and they said get rid of him. So they trade him to Washington for this lopsided trade with Gil Cohen. Gil Cohen was like Roy Sievers in 1949. He had a fantastic rookie season. Everything was great. He came to the majors and couldn't hit the pitching. So Roy went to the Senators in 1954, stayed there for 6 years and set franchise home run records, and Gil Cohen was out of baseball in 4 years. So Roy sets the franchise home run record with 24 in 1954, 25 in 55, 29 in 56. He sets his sight for 57, and he battles with Mickey Mantle and Ted Williams to the last month of the season, besting all of them with his great year of 42 home runs, 114 RBI, and 331 total bases. The first time in baseball history that a player with a losing last place team ever wins a home run crown. The very first time. Which is an ignominious honor, I would say, at that particular point. Who really wants that? You know, that's like 300 home runs in the minors. It's like, okay. You know, that kind of stuff. But what I'm telling you here, folks, that you'll feel my pain. You'll feel this. He comes in 54 and all of a sudden, oh, there's a home run. 55, oh, there's a home run. 56, oh, there's a home run. 57, oh, yes! I mean, everyone I talk to, when I talk to this book, everyone would say, my dad took me to the game in 1950-something and Roy hit a home run. It seems like Roy hit a home run every night, you know. To everybody that talked to, whenever they were there, Roy was hitting a home run. But that's the way that it was. He had a prodigious output in Washington, D.C., hitting home runs with one arm, as I said before. He's got a busted arm here, and it isn't until really 1956 where he's able to get his full swing with his follow-through. He's hitting most everything with his lead arm. All right, well, that's pretty much everyone does that with their opposite arms, but most home run hitters are pretty much, except for Jason Worth, who hits with both hands. It's one of the few players that still hits with both hands. But you know, he's hitting home runs, and really, Roy said he was a wrist hitter. He didn't power from his legs. He was a wrist hitter. So he's got, it's all coming from here, real snapping like that. And he's only got one arm to do this. And it's a 407 fence in 1954 when he comes to the Washington Senators. Griffiths decides we'll bring the fences in to a comfortable 385. Oh, please. Okay. You know, and then it isn't until 56, after the 56 season, that he pulls in the fences to 350. Okay, great. Well, everybody else feasts on that, including, you know, Mickey Mantle and everybody else. But Roy is hitting more home runs because the fences are shorter. He's a dead pull hitter straight to left field. So Roy is feasting on the new things. Roy was Vice President Nixon's favorite, and one of the finest things that I saw, I wish I could get it away from Sean, his daughter, but they love it to death. There's a big, huge picture in his living room of the formal shot of President Nixon with his sign, you know, to Roy Sievers, my dear friend, you know, Vice President Richard Nixon, 1957. It's a huge picture, you know, personally autographed and the whole thing. He loved Roy Sievers. Jim Lemon was Dwight Eisenhower's favorite player. And Jim Lemon was his roomie there. And the vice president's on hand to give him a night at the end of 1957 and on September the 16th. And he's showered with all kinds of of presents and presents for his wife and all kinds of stuff. So he was really, really loved in Washington, D.C., really, really loved. And he breaks down. And so in 1958, he's the king of the rubber chicken circuit, and he's going all over the place, winning Man of the Year awards, Athlete of the Year awards, all kinds of stuff, and he's hanging out with all kinds of people, Bob Hope, Rita Hayworth. There's a funny story in the book about Rita Hayworth. You'll have to read it. this was an homage to a real good friend of mine who was a circuit court judge in Montgomery County, Maryland. Bill Turner was his name, who was his bat boy, and Roy got him into trouble, and that's a great story in the book. I won't go into it. It's a little long, because I've got something really important to get to at the end here. And there's Bill Turner with his friends, Bob Farmer and Jim Ryan. I don't know if you remember Jim Ryan. He's the boy in the scoreboard. Life magazine did a picture of him peeking out of the scoreboard in right field in Griffith Stadium, and they were going to run, and they didn't. But the picture still circulated somewhere or another, and there's Jim's face sticking out of the scoreboard, and was really a lot of fun. And what kid isn't going to love that, to be in the scoreboard and see the game and run the score at Griffith Stadium? It was a hand run scoreboard, just like it was in the Green Monster. There's Bill in 1958. And there's Roy on the knife and fork circuit with Supreme Court Justice Thomas Clark. This was a big testimony that they gave to Dr. George Bennett in Baltimore. There were so many people that Dr. Bennett fixed. That's not Dr. Bennett right there. He's a lot older than that. Including DiMaggio. He helped with DiMaggio's bone spurs. There was so many. Eddie Arcaro had a knee injury that nearly kept him out of racing. And so he was like the sports medicine doctor at the time. Very, very well respected. This is a lot of fun. This is the singing senators, which Bob Wolf, he's over here on this side. He got together on the long road trips, trying to break up the boredom of long road trips, and he put together a singing group, and these guys would all get together. It was also very important because the Hispanic guys were in the back of the bus, and they're singing along to these songs, and they have really, really good voices. And, you know, Bob Porterfield said, you know, you ought to get these guys to come up. They're really singing. So Bob Wolf went to the back of the bus and got these guys to come up and really sort of inculcated the Hispanic players, Ramos, Pascual, Jose Valdivieso, Carlos Paula, who could barely speak any English, and they got them to sing, and the magic of music was that, you know, they'd all sing together. On this particular day, this was 1958, and this was on the Dave Garraway show. How many people remember Dave Garraway? Thank you, I'm not that old then. They sang twice for 2 7.5-minute segments. That's almost unheard of in TV nowadays without a commercial every 13 minutes. And so this is Roy as the swinging stunt double in the movie Damn Yankees. Tab Hunter had a really great swing. He looked like Williams, Esther Williams. And so they had to have someone in there. So what they did was that they used Roy, but they superimposed him the opposite way, flipping the film, because Roy was right-handed and Tab Hunter was a left-handed. Joe Hardy in the movie was a left-handed hitter. And so they had to reflip the negative for that particular thing. And I tried desperately to find out from someone, 5 minutes? Oh, man. All right. So that's the fearsome foursome in 1959, which gave me great hope. A great smashing home run hitting team, and they still wound up tied for dead last in team RBI total because they were only hitting solo home runs. There's nobody on base. So Roy goes from he goes to Chicago in 1960 for 2 years. He goes to the Phillies for 2 years, 62 to 64. He's traded in the middle of the year before the Phillies fold up at the end of the year. I'm sure you're all familiar with the fabulous fold. And he goes back to the Washington Senators in 1965. But one of the reasons why I really wanted to get into this particular topic is that if you look at this and read through this and do it quickly, Roy was one of the most undervalued and underrated players in the history of the game, as far as I'm concerned. And I believe if you read this thing here, you'll see that Bill James, our godfather, would say exactly the same thing. He wasn't glib. He wasn't big into the press. He had a comfortable home life. He didn't drink. He didn't smoke. He didn't do drugs. He didn't run around. He was under the radar most of the time. And these people are definitely underrated than the Joe Pepitones in the world who smoked, drank everything in the universe. You know? And so, you know, he didn't get the kind of recognition that he deserved. And had he been, and everybody I talked to, Albie Pearson and Frank Thomas of the Pirates, and everyone said if he had played for New York or Detroit or Boston, he would be in the Hall of Fame without any question. And so these are his lifetime stats, the things which are important. And the reason why it's important to me is that in 1956, Calvin Griffith wanted to sell the team. Okay, he was being courted by all kinds of people. This was the great escape, the migration to California. And he couldn't move the team because of two things: minority owner Gabriel Murphy, who threatened a lawsuit if he moved the team; Estes Kiefhofer, who expressed his disinterest in doing that; and Roy, who was hitting home runs left and right and was actually making money for a last place team. They were actually making a little bit of money. Why? Because Griffith was a parsimonious bastard and didn't pay anybody anything whatsoever, and brought up cheap talent from Cuba, and wouldn't pay Roy what he was worth, and so he was still making hot dog and popcorn money off of Roy's backside. So that led to the Kiefhofer hearings in 1957-58, which caused baseball to expand in 1960, and he eventually got to move. But my contention is that because he put people in the seats, he increased attendance by over 40%. He made money for a last place team. Griffith would have moved that team in 1956. Washington would have had a complete void because they didn't want to expand until 1960. It wasn't a given that there would have been a team in Washington in 1960 had he moved. I'm saying that there would have been nothing in Washington, and maybe not even in Washington Nationals franchise, if Roy Sievers hadn't stopped Griffith from hitting balls, from taking the team out to another place. And because of that, Roy Sievers should be in the Washington Nationals Ring of Honor. So if anybody knows anything in Nats Park, please let me know. So I'm going to talk to Ted Lerner some way, shape, or form. I'm going to kidnap his car, something like that, and say, you need to put this man in the Ring of Honor. You just put in Frank Howard. God bless him. He needs to be, because Frank Howard broke Roy Sievers' franchise home run record. So if there's no Roy Sievers, there's no Frank Howard. Okay? It's just that simple. So without Roy, there's no Howard, there's no franchise, there's no baseball, and there's my man. And I really, really enjoyed this talk. I really, really enjoyed doing this project with him. He's the nicest man that I ever met. And everybody that I talked to said the same thing. He's one of the nicest people in baseball. Thank you very much. Really, if you have any questions, I've got a microphone right here. Please let me know. Any questions? No? I'm that good? Really? Oh, okay.
I don't have a question. Can you hear me? I don't have a question. I'm from St. Louis.
Yes, sir.
I saw Roy Sievers the first year.
Oh.
I'm a member of the St. Louis Browns fan club. And George Talk, I attest to that, he was really, really a nice person.
He really was.
When I taught school, one of my students was Roy Sievers' nephew.
Oh.
And he used to talk about Roy Sievers.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Die hard Browns fan.
Go Browns.
I cried like the devil when they left St. Louis.
Everybody did.
And Roy Sievers' first year was really a blessing. So that's why I'm here.
Thank you. Thank you so very much. He was beloved in St. Louis, and he still is. So thank you all very much. Really appreciate it. I'll be at the McFarland table with you. Do you have a question, sir?
A big what man? need the big heavy bat?
No. I actually have one of his later model bats. It's not that heavy. Maybe it's a 32, 34, something like that. So I got to get off. Thanks so much. I'll see you at the McFarland table.